We are checking in on tick and mosquito season on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. A variety of diseases can be spread by ticks, and the Department of Health Services says it's deer ticks that are spreading the most illnesses here. The risk of Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases is increasing as our state is seeing more months of the year when ticks are active. Have you seen any in your area? What are you doing to protect yourself? We're at 800-642-1234. Lyric Bartholomew is a UW-Madison professor who studies infectious disease agents and mosquitoes, ticks, and other parasites. She's director of the Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease. Lyric, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Morning. It's so nice to be with you again.
Well, how is the tick population looking for Wisconsin at this point?
You know, we had an update yesterday in our Center of Excellence to hear about ticks and mosquitoes across a sort of five-state region, and it seems like it's patchwork. So in some places, we're seeing perhaps more ticks, maybe in the southern part of the state, but in the northern part of the state, it looks pretty similar to years previous. So it seems like it's probably a sort of individualized experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in this patchwork, though, have you seen ticks spread basically across the state?
You know, we really have seen those black-legged ticks that you mentioned, Kate, march their way across the state. I say that, but, you know, of course, they've got to be clinging to something else.
I like the imagery. Yeah.
right. But in fact, in order to migrate, they really move on some other animal. So with the movement of deer and birds and other things, ticks have tracked across the state. And we've really found them in all but just a couple of counties. And I have no doubt they're in those counties too.
Well, Lyric, what helps ticks thrive? The warmer months, of course, the warmer weather, but what also helps them produce?
Yeah, you know, and interestingly, Kate, ticks are super cold hardy too. So they're not terribly fazed by the deep cold. They're of course not super active during that time, but they can survive a Wisconsin winter better than you and I can, you know, out on the forest floor. But ticks are really happy in places where they have access to blood. That's the bottom line. And so what we see is when populations of mice are thriving and populations of deer are thriving, ticks have really what they need in order to have robust populations.
We're talking with Lyric Bartholomew, who's a UW-Madison professor, studies infectious disease agents in mosquitoes and ticks. She's giving us a read on tick season around the state, taking your questions. Have you been seeing more ticks in your area? What are you doing to protect yourself? Have you had Lyme disease? What was that like? 800-642-1234 to join in. Jan is here from Oak Creek. Hi, Jan. You found a tick on yourself.
Yes, I did this morning about an hour ago, and I think from what I see on the internet, it might be a Lone Star tick because it has a little white dot on it.
Okay.
So I want to know what I should do.
Well, Jan, I'm so glad that you found the tick on you. You did all the right things by checking around and finding it on you and getting it off. So that's the first step. Well done. And then if you'd like, we, through the University of Wisconsin, and especially at Susan Paskowitz's lab, the Wisconsin Medical Entomology Lab, we do have services available to citizens to take a picture and send us a picture of your tick, and we can help to confirm the identification. So if you have a smartphone, can take a photo and upload it to the medical entomology site at UW-Madison, some of our experts here on campus would be able to identify it for you. And confirm or deny whether it's a Lone Star tick. I know a lot of people are concerned about that tick making its way into Wisconsin.
And
good
when
on you.
Yeah, the Lone Star tick, would that be from Texas?
It's definitely a southern tick, yes.
Okay.
And so it's aptly named. But it's been really interesting to watch that tick over the last 10 or 15 years or so. Since I've been in this business, it's really, as I said with the black-legged tick, it's really marched its way, in this case, northward. So used to be a tick that we really thought of as being, you know, sort of south in the United States. And we see it increasingly more my colleagues from Minnesota were just mentioning that a lot of people had encountered Lone Star ticks in Minnesota. So it could well be that Jan has one, and we'd like to know.
Jan,
the other thing that we have, Kate, is we also offer something called the Tick App. So we've developed this app for smartphone use. So if people have interest in ticks and they want to get updates on what to do for tick prevention and have access to easy access to tick identification services, we offer the Tick App as well. So I encourage people who are interested in using their smartphones and providing us with information about the ticks they see to put that on and enroll in our study.
Yeah, and we have a link to the Tick App at wpr.org/mornings. I want to go back to Jan for a moment. Jan, were you out in grass or an area where there have been ticks before? Do you know where you got it?
Yeah, I don't know where I got it. I woke up and when I was taking a shower, I looked down and here it was sitting on my abdomen.
Oh.
And it was sort of attached. It wasn't like engorged or anything, but it was like, I thought, what's that spot? And I pulled it off and I said, sure enough, it's got legs and it's a tick.
Good for you for finding it. That's great.
Yeah. Jan, thank you so much for the call. Lyric, you helped develop that Tick App. What are you learning from the app?
It's been so interesting to have the app and have people telling us about where they're encountering ticks. So just like Jan's story, we're getting to hear stories on a really broad scale with thousands of users across the United States. And we're learning things about when and where they're encountering ticks. So just like the question you just asked, Kate, we're fueled by the same idea. What are people doing when they're outdoors that puts them in contact with ticks? And one of the things that we saw by studying both Wisconsin and the Midwest and also the Northeast is that there are real differences in people's behavior between the Midwest and Northeast in terms of how much people like to be outdoors. And so we found that Wisconsinites, for example, and not surprisingly, are pretty outdoorsy and do things like mow their own lawns and spend a lot of time, engaging in recreational activities. And that was different from what Northeasterners were doing. Hmm. And so we may be out more, encountering more ticks. We've also really seen ticks kind of moving into spaces that we hadn't predicted them to be. That the black-legged ticks tend to like sort of scrubby, brushy areas around and in forests. And some of our team members, both through the Tick App and through surveillance that we've been doing, have started to see ticks more in people's backyards.
Mm.
The other thing that we're really interested in and what is what have the impacts of the pandemic been on people's exposure to ticks? And people were actually trying to stay socially distant from other people, but sometimes really we're getting outdoors more. And so the paradox perhaps is that in order to avoid the virus, people may have been encountering more ticks just because they were outdoors more.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. Amy now in Beloit with an experience. Amy, hi.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to talk to you about an experience my husband and I had a few weeks ago. We were camping in Tomahawk, Wisconsin, and had found incredible numbers of ticks, that had both bitten us and that we were trying to pull off before they bit us. And a few days later, my husband developed a fever of 103 degrees that lasted for 4 days until we got to the doctor. And the doctor tested him for Lyme disease and put him on doxycycline, an antibiotic, and he got better. But the nurses that I work with did some research and said, we don't think he tested negative for Lyme, but they said, we think he has anaplasmosis, which I guess is the black tick or the black legged tick, disease that they carry. And then shortly after that, I developed a bullseye rash. And so the two of us have large bottles of doxycycline that are, you know, kind of a miserable thing to take. But I just couldn't believe that the illness that my husband had, and had no idea that this problem was developing in Wisconsin already.
Amy, thank you for sharing that experience. Lyric.
Amy, this is a really important story. And it really underscores one of the things that's kind of unique and frustrating about Wisconsin ticks is that we have just found more and more different types of diseases that can be transmitted by that black-legged tick that's happening here in Wisconsin. And so, you know, we see that sometimes ticks are infected with more than one bacterium and can transmit more than one thing to people. So you've seen it. There are at least a handful of different things that ticks transmit in Wisconsin: anaplasmosis, ehrlichiosis, and Lyme. And people do encounter them, and we're seeing probably an increase, especially in anaplasmosis cases over the years. So it's an unfortunate situation, but just like our previous caller, Janet, kudos to you, right, for noticing the ticks, for noticing that you had symptoms after being in contact with those ticks, and for really getting into the doctor's office to get doxycycline. If we can catch them early, we can do a tremendous job of keeping people healthy.
Lyric Bartholomew is a UW-Madison professor, studies infectious disease agents in ticks and mosquitoes, other parasites as well. What questions do you have about repellents? Have you tried natural repellents? What's worked? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're discussing tick and mosquito season here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is home to dozens of species of mosquitoes, thanks to UW-Madison's entomology department for that accounting. And notably, too, they say many of these are not found biting people. How are the mosquitoes in your community this year? Are they super aggressive, not so bad? Do you wear insect repellents? What works to prevent bites? 800-642-1234. Lyric Bartholomew is UW-Madison professor and stays with us. Lyric, we're going to move on to mosquitoes in a moment, but Kevin in Dodge County wanted to ask about a vaccine, and I want to know, why can dogs get vaccinated against Lyme disease and people cannot?
You know, we've had a sort of fraught history when it comes to vaccines and Lyme disease. There was a Lyme vaccine that was approved for use in humans, and then some of the side effects associated with that vaccine and probably the extent to which there was profitability of the vaccine made it so that it came off of the market shelf. And there is still that vaccine for dogs. And I think a lot of people have noted exactly what Kevin and Kate have noted, that a vaccine would be really helpful, especially in a place like Wisconsin where, you know, we're really a kind of hot spot for Lyme and other tick-borne diseases. It would be great to imagine having a vaccine. And the federal government has started to invest more in a bigger way in laboratories across the U.S. that are trying to do the work to figure out what would be the best way to vaccinate people against Lyme bacteria. It's kind of a complicated one because, you know, we can get Lyme disease repeatedly. It's a pathogen that can really change the way it appears to avoid our immune systems, and so it's
tricky.
Real bear of a problem. But there are some labs that are tackling it now, and we, you know, can be hopeful.
Let's go to Carla in Madison. Carla, hi.
Hi. Recently, I was diagnosed with QCVR, which is coccilia. And I know it comes from large animals, but I haven't been around, worked with large animals in a long time. And we also know it is a tick disease. It's a rickettsia, so it can be spread by ticks like Lyme and anaplasmosis. I was wondering if you know what species of ticks might be carrying it, and if we do see it in ticks in Wisconsin. I don't recall having a tick on me, but, you know, this is our current working diagnosis. I have Q fever.
Mm. Wow. That's an intense diagnosis, and thank you for calling in to talk about it. That's right. This is one of those interesting diseases where there's transmission potential from ticks, but there are other environmental exposure possibilities. As far as I know, we haven't seen it very often as a tick-related disease in Wisconsin. But I'm glad that you've caught it and you're tackling it. And I'm sorry to hear that you've gotten that diagnosis.
Our labs testing pretty aggressively ticks to see what diseases they're carrying?
This is a great question. This is something that we really benefit from having great colleagues at the Centers for Disease Control in Fort Collins, Colorado, in particular. There's this epicenter of folks who are studying ticks and tick-borne diseases. And they're doing a lot of diagnostics in ticks to understand what ticks are infected with and kind of what the risk is according to how many ticks are infected and what life stage of ticks are infected. So the CDC does a lot of that. And it's really sort of state to state in terms of capacity. It's not something where, so we don't test ticks for, as a general rule, as they come off of people at the state level, but there are some labs that would do that. So if you had a tick on you, you could find a laboratory and contract them to test for ticks.
Oh.
It's all kind of done in a scattershot kind of way. So it depends on the level of capacity in the state and who has the expertise and the resources to get that done.
Expertise and capacity, I would imagine. Yeah. Talking with Lyric Bartholomé, who is a UW-Madison professor, studies infectious disease agents in mosquitoes, ticks, and other parasites. Lisa is joining us from Brookfield. Hi, Lisa. What is your situation?
Good morning. I have a child. Well, she's not a child anymore. She's an adult, but she's had severe headaches, and one of her doctors thought it was a Lyme disease or whatever, but I don't remember if she ever tested her for it. And I was just wondering if that's something a primary doctor would do, or do you need to go to a specialist? That lady was a specialist, but she did. I don't remember her testing her for Lyme disease.
Who tests for Lyme disease? Yeah, great question.
Yeah. So you certainly can go to your primary care doctor and ask for a Lyme disease test, or there are also at the UW, for example, really great people who are experts in infectious disease who might be able to do that for you too.
Jim and called in from Juneau called to say 2 years ago, Jim was a tower technician for a cell phone tower. And when they looked down at the gravel base, there was a carpet of ticks. And Jim is wondering, are they attracted to the heat? What attracts ticks?
Oh, isn't that interesting? I wonder what kind of tick that was.
I bet you do.
Yeah. So it brings up a sort of tangential story, so forgive me, but there's a new tick that has invaded the U.S. Called the Asian longhorn tick, Haemophysalis longicornis. And that tick is we first started seeing it over in the northeastern states, and it's progressively moving westward. And that's a really interesting and kind of terrifying tick because it doesn't need males. It's what we call parthenogenic. So it's like females only, and they have this amazing reproductive potential. So there's like swarms of ticks. And a friend of mine from the CDC showed me a video of those ticks swarming on a utility vehicle. So the utility vehicle was running and the exhaust was, of course, moving out into the air, and the truck was just moving with these ticks that had swarmed around it. Sort of the thing out of nightmares or a B movie. And it could be that in that case, those ticks were attracted to heat, maybe, right? And then also some of the elements that were in the exhaust of the truck. As far as a tower goes, that's a super interesting observation. And it could be that the ticks were somehow attracted to something going on there. It could also be that there just happened to be like a nest of ticks that had, been left there by the mother tick the year before or something like that. So it'd be really interesting to know what kind of tick it was that you saw under the tower.
Well, Lyric, thank you so much for joining us.
It's always fun to join you, Kate. Thank you for the invitation.
Lyric Bartholomew is a UW-Madison professor who studies infectious disease agents in mosquitoes, ticks, other parasites. She's director of the Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease. Ahead this hour, we look at the recent Supreme Court ruling involving a Pennsylvania high school cheerleader who was punished by her school for her social media posts. Should schools be allowed to do this? What does it mean for freedom of speech? 800-642-1234. Stay with us. News Update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. As neighbors may be safely gathering for the 4th of July holiday this weekend, here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about meeting new people on your block.
Moving to a new community can spark a host of challenges. Marisol Gonzalez of Madison shares a story about trying to win over her new neighbors with food and kindness.
6 years ago, I was moving to a very white neighborhood. And when we moved to that neighborhood, my husband told me that one of the neighbors told him she will be watching us and if she noticed anything wrong with us, she will call the police right away. In that moment, I gotta say that I like people to like me, and I'm very friendly. So when my husband told me that, it just triggered my obsession for this neighbor to like me. So I decided to do what Mexicans does, which is a party. I bake a lot of cookies, and I make fancy invitations, and I went to the whole block to invite all of these neighbors. Some of them, they don't even open the door, but I left the cookies in the mailbox. And so by the time of the party came, I cleaned the house. I asked my children to be dressed nicely. And for a Mexican also, this is a big deal. I had everything ready 20 minutes before the party started. By the time for the party started, I was starting to get very, very nervous because I made a lot of food. I made tostadas, guacamole, I had tamales, I had empanadas, hot chocolate, beer, horchata. By the time for the party started, nobody was there. And by that time, I already knew white people a little bit. So I knew that they usually come 5 minutes before the party started. So I was very nervous because nobody was knocking my door. And I was thinking a lot of thoughts like, what if they really, really don't like us? What if they don't gonna give us a chance? And all of a sudden, 5 minutes after the party started, somebody knocked at the door. And there was two old ladies who brought us like plants and welcoming cards. They stay only for about 15 minutes, grab an empanada, and take home a cup of hot chocolate. And you will think I was disappointed, but as I say, I'm a very friendly person. That was the best day in the new neighborhood for me. I decided to continue doing more parties because that works for two neighbors. So I keep persisting doing that. And any single chance I had to make a party, to meet more neighbors, I will do it. all of a sudden, all of these neighbors start to come to my parties, and then they start to making their own parties. Last October, we had to move out of the neighborhood. What happened is the neighbors put a party together for us. Even some of them cry and ask us, why are you guys leaving? Don't leave us. The bond that we made in that white neighborhood with only one family of color was very amazing. And the most important thing that happened is that everybody liked me.
Marisol Gonzalez's story came to us from the podcast Inside Stories, which features Madison storytellers and digs deeper into their lives. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Carl Christensen.
And now to the case of the Pennsylvania cheerleader who won a free speech case. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of the teen who was denied a spot in the cheerleading squad after her profane social media post. The High Court concluded the district had violated Brandy Levy's freedom of speech under the First Amendment. Here's Levy speaking with Reuters.
I'm proud of sticking through it all the way to here. I really am, because it's going to prove a point that schools shouldn't be able to punish students for how they express their feelings.
What do you think of this ruling? Should schools be able to take action against students for speech and actions that happen off school grounds? 800-642-1234. Frank Lamonti is a professor of media law at the University of Florida, where he directs the Brechner Center for Freedom of Information. Frank, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate. I guess your program is going to go from ticks to TikToks this morning.
Oh, that was a good one. I wasn't ready for that. Well, can you walk us through the crux of this case and how a post on Snapchat in 2017 got all the way up to the High Court?
Sure. So the crux of the case is exactly what you just explained. Brandy Levy is a 14-year-old high school freshman in Pennsylvania. She's disappointed that she's not chosen for varsity cheerleading. And so she and a friend on a Saturday at a convenience store outside of school grounds or school events decide to record a little Snapchat post where they engage in a vent about how frustrated they are about school. They flip their middle fingers to the smartphone camera, and it's got some strong profanity in it. And it goes up on Brandy Levy's Snapchat account, where it quickly disappears after 24 hours, like they do. But the post came to the attention of the cheerleading coach, who then brought it to the attention of school administrators, and she was disciplined by way of a year's suspension from participating in cheer. She brings the case to the federal courts under the First Amendment. The First Amendment, after all, protects all of us against being punished by the government, and a public school is a government agency for the content of our speech. And she wins all the way up the district court and then the Court of Appeals, and the school district takes it to the Supreme Court. And of course, the Supreme Court doesn't take cases just to decide whether one school wrongfully punished one child. They take cases to draw broad lines that will guide future courts and future attorneys in similar types of cases. So that was what we were all anticipating and I guess hoping for, was some clarity about the larger issue, a recurring one in courts throughout the country. Where does a school's punitive authority begin and end when a student is not on school grounds, not using school facilities or school equipment, just on her personal time talking about the school? Yeah. At what point would a school be able to kind of reach into your off-campus personal life and discipline you for what you say?
Yeah, and those boundaries are really tricky. I mean, it was an 8-1 ruling, decisive, but, you know, Judge Breyer said authorizing schools to police both on and off campus speech potentially, you know, includes all the speech a student utters during a 24-hour day. And he called it a heavy burden to justify the intervention off school grounds. What did you make of how Breyer expressed himself in this case, in this ruling?
Well, I think the court navigated its way past a lot of landmines. If you look at what the school district and their supporters were asking the court to do, it would have really been quite a breathtaking reallocation of government authority over individuals. They were asking the court to knock down entirely the wall between off and on campus speech and to declare that all student speech 24/7 throughout their lives is equally punishable by a school, no matter where and when it happens, because it has the potential to cause people to react to it at the school. And as the court wisely, I think, discerned, this was not just a social media case at all. This was a case about all off-campus speech, so that a student would potentially be subject to discipline if she went to the school board meeting and spoke at the open mic period, if she gave an interview to her local radio station. All of that would now become equally punishable by the school as if she had said it inside of a classroom during the school day. And the court was just not prepared to go that way, which I think was a wise exercise of discretion on the court's part. What they failed to do was go further and to give us a bright line standard or a bright line test as to where disciplinary authority begins and ends. If you go back 52 years ago, the court did give us that bright line in a case called the Tinker case, the case we all study in junior high school.
Tinker versus Des Moines. Yeah.
Right. Students being punished for wearing anti-war black armbands to school. And in that case, the court did draw a bright line and they said the school's punitive authority does not kick in until the point where the speech threatens a substantial and material disruption of the school, meaning something more than just some hurt feelings, something more than just an exchange of harsh words, but actually preventing the school from being able to do its job. And I think many of us were looking for that same kind of a generic bright line in the Mahanoy case that could be applied in all future contexts, and we didn't get that. We got a very narrow and a fact-specific decision that clearly protects this kind of speech, which is just venting about your displeasure with this government agency.
Well, the district did bring up things like bullying and how to monitor and prevent that, that they would have to intervene whether it would happen on or off school grounds.
Yeah, and I think that, frankly, is the ground on which the court was hesitant to tread in this case, which clearly did not involve bullying, which clearly involved a very different factual scenario where a student was just expressing her dissatisfaction with a school policy decision. And after all, that's exactly why we have a First Amendment, right? So that people can express their dissatisfaction with government policy decisions and not feel intimidated in doing so. So I think they left that purposefully for another day. And that other day is inevitably going to come. That type of a case where a student is punished for harsh words directed at a classmate, as opposed to just directed at the school generally, directed at a classmate that puts that classmate in fear or in discomfort, that case inevitably will come. And I think there are some signals that the court is prepared to relax the off-campus, on-campus wall in a future case if the facts are sufficiently compelling, and these facts just will not.
We have University of Florida media law professor Frank Lamonti, who stays with us on student speech rights. Do you have a teenager at home? Are you monitoring their social media? Do you think that schools should be able to punish students for their social media activity off campus? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing a recent student speech rights victory, the ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court that a former cheerleader's 2017 Snapchat post laden with F-bombs about her high school is protected speech under the First Amendment. Do you have concerns about freedom of speech as it relates to technology and social media? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. We have law professor Frank Lamonti, who leads the Brechner Center for Freedom of Information at the University of Florida, and he's with us for about 10 more minutes. So, Frank, I just want to quickly look at Justice Clarence Thomas, who is the dissent in this case, who brought up the 1859 decision by the Vermont Supreme Court against a student who called his teacher old. What did you make of the dissent here?
Well, to no one's surprise, Justice Clarence Thomas has consistently, every time a student First Amendment case has come before the court, dissented from the view that students have any First Amendment protections whatsoever. Justice Thomas is the originalist's originalist, and he believes in a very antiquated notion of the way that the Constitution works that's rooted in the time of the Founding Fathers. And I think the problem with his view, frankly, is that at the time of the Founding Fathers, school was a vastly different place than it is today. I mean, you typically went to school 4 or 5 years around your farming duties, and the school was typically not run by the government. It might be run by a church, and it might be taught by somebody who was 17 or 18 years old. And there were no compulsory truancy laws under which you could be arrested if you didn't show up. So it was just a vastly different place than it is today. And so the rules that might have been in the minds of Madison and Jefferson at the time of the Constitution clearly don't apply in a situation where now it's possible to still go to school. The average age of a college student in America is 26 years old. And the idea that a 26-year-old might have no First Amendment right to criticize the government would certainly have been anathema to Madison and Jefferson.
Well, you mentioned college students, and there are other cases that are taking this up, certainly. One involved a University of Tennessee graduate student who really liked the Cardi B song WAP. And, you know, can you point to this case as and what you see out of freedom of speech?
Yeah, so I think that case, the student's name is Kimberly D.A., and she's 27 years old. She's in graduate school at the University of Tennessee. And just as you said, Kate, she's a fan of Cardi B, and she likes to use Instagram to have fun in her off hours and to talk about the songs that she enjoys and to dance and perform along with them. And somebody brings these posts to the attention of her college and says, I think that this is an unprofessional way for one of your students to behave. What are you going to do about this? And the college initiates expulsion procedures against her, saying that you acted in an unprofessional manner on your Instagram and it's unbefitting the pharmacy profession for which you are studying. And I think this is a object lesson of what happens when the courts don't draw bright lines to confine disciplinary authority, because unprofessionalism certainly seems like a reach into a person's off-campus behavior that should be beyond the power of a governmental agency. After all, we don't call it professional media, we call it social media. You are supposed to be able to have fun and talk about your political opinions without fear that the government is looking over your shoulder every hour of the day and night. And I think inevitably that will be the next case that needs to present itself to the Supreme Court, is where do we allocate that authority and where do we draw the boundary lines when the speaker is an adult-aged college student? And you can read in the court's opinion that they sort of telegraph that they think that the reason that a student's First Amendment rights diminish in the school setting is in deference to their parents' child-rearing authority. Mm-hmm. That the reason that Brandy Levy might not have the full benefit of the First Amendment that you and I do is because her parents have a role in raising her and disciplining her. But of course, for a 27-year-old graduate student, that's just not in play anymore. So I think there's every chance that when the Supreme Court weighs in, they will give more latitude and more elbow room for college students to express themselves without fear of punishment.
What is the status of this University of Tennessee case?
Well, she's bringing a First Amendment suit, and it's like many suits. You mentioned Brandy Levy did her post 4.5 years ago, and these cases take quite a lot of time to work their way through the federal courts, and inevitably either it will slowly work its way through the courts, or as often is the case, it will settle out and resolve, and hopefully she'll get herself reinstated to school if that's what she chooses. But these cases are popping up all over the country. Before the DA case, there was one out in New Mexico involving a 26-year-old medical student who also was disciplined by his school for a political rant on Facebook where he just used a lot of profanity to express his strong anti-abortion views. And he too was disciplined for that entirely off-campus speech in which he didn't in any way connect it up to the school or his med school status. And he lost that case. And the Supreme Court declined to take his appeal. So these cases are cropping up all over the country. And it's only a matter of time before the court has to confront, where do we draw the line and allow people to have the full benefit of the First Amendment even when they're enrolled in an educational institution.
We're talking with Frank Lamonti, who's a professor of law at the University of Florida, director of the Brechner Center for Freedom of Information. You can weigh in. When should a school or other government entity be able to regulate content on social media? Should that be age-driven? Do you think judges who don't know about social media and don't use it should be ruling on it? 800-642-1234. Frank, let's go to that point. And, you know, this social media being for a younger set of people sometimes, is there any concern that a case like this could be ruled on by judges who don't know their way around Snapchat or other social media platforms?
Yeah, I think that's quite right. And many people, frankly, were nervous about seeing a Supreme Court of people, none of whom are digital natives. I can confidently say that Samuel Alito has never Snapchatted in his life. And seeing people whose only interaction with social media in their entire professional adult lives has been being cautioned about staying the heck off of it. And for that reason, many people were nervous that the court would give in to this kind of phobia about the power of social media to do harm, which was a lot of the school's argument, frankly, that we should change the rules that normally cabin the authority of government agencies because of the power and the reach of social media. And if you study the First Amendment and you litigate these cases, you find out that over the years, government agencies have always made this argument every time there's a new form of communication, going back to comic books, going back to motion pictures, and more recently, video games. It's always been argued that whatever the latest innovation in communication is so much more dangerous than any other one that's ever come before that we need to rewrite the First Amendment rulebook and give the government more regulatory authority. And to their credit, so far, the Supreme Court has not given into that phobia. And they've said the First Amendment is the First Amendment. Amendment is the First Amendment, and it is platform neutral.
I'm wondering, as we start to wrap up here, do you see school districts, universities really being aggressive and persistent about taking these cases and driving them to court? Or do you see more settlements in these freedom of speech cases out of court?
Well, sure. That's what normally happens, is at some point somebody blinks. At some point somebody says, this is just not worth 4, 5, 6 years of litigating anymore. Because after all, particularly if you're a student, you're in a very short time turnaround. You know, Brandy Levy has no interest. She's a sophomore in college. She has no interest in joining the varsity cheer squad, I assure you. So that ship has sailed. And so most of the time, either the student or the educational institution decides, look, let's just resolve this. And that's one reason why we don't have a ton of guidance from the higher appellate courts and the Supreme Court, is that the case just goes away. But at some point, somebody is going to have to be the Brandy Levy of college campus and is going to have to stick with the case and decide to litigate it, not just for their own personal benefit, but for the benefit of future generations of students who really need that assurance. I mean, that's one of the things that the Supreme Court has always told us in the realm of the First Amendment, is that we have to give speakers what they call breathing space. You have to be confident that you are protected against government retaliation, or else you will censor yourself. And so that's why it's so important for the court to draw some bright lines of authority.
Frank, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity, Kate.
Frank Lamonti is a professor of media law at the University of Florida, where he directs the Brechner Center for Freedom of Information. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.